Hello, everyone. This is Sparkle On with Davey Jags. I define your sparkle as your happiness, passion, and self-worth. Nothing can ever dim your light. Today, I am so excited to have one of the writers that I admire the most, Olivia Gatwood, joining us today. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So Olivia is a poet, a novelist. Her work has been recognized internationally. She covers topics on girlhood, queerness, and a bunch of other things that we're going to dive into today. But her newest novel that just came out is Here, Whoever You Are, Honey. This is your first novel. People Magazine has described this as a fever dream for the AI age. So I really feel like this is a really important novel right now, just with technology advances, but also what I love about it is kind of explores complicated dynamics between female friendships. And mm-hmm. so I'm really gravitating towards that kind of work lately. So thank you so much for being here. But I really wanted to start at the beginning of how you initially started writing. I know you come from the education background with your upbringing, but I'm really interested in what was your first start into that career.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like so many people who, at least artists, but I think especially writers, you just sort of always were a writer, you know, like you're the kid that people buy journals for Christmas. Like it's just sort of what you do. And I feel like the minute that I could write in any kind of, in any discernible way, that's what I was doing. Mm-hmm. I, you know, was always writing short stories by hand. And then eventually, this was the 90s, we got a desktop computer. I just feel like it was the way that I understood how to communicate with the world. But you know, people don't tell you that you can, at least when I was growing up, there wasn't a kind of clear understanding that you could be a writer for a living. Mm-hmm. That was sort of a far reach. I don't even know that I had any real models for what that looked like. So the idea then is that you are a good writer and you use that, you apply that somewhere. So maybe, you know, maybe you become a teacher, maybe you get into magazines, like, you know, but the idea of being a creative writer was kind of, that would never happen. Mm-hmm. That's what I thought. So I went to school for writing and I didn't know what I wanted to do. And by school, I mean, I did my undergraduate in fiction. And I didn't know how I would apply that. I interned at a bunch of magazines. I was like trying to, I was like writing listicles of like top 10 rooftop bars in Brooklyn, which was like terrible. I applied to a Fulbright. I applied to the Peace Corps. I was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. And then my friend Megan Falley, she's a poet and writer. We got together, we were on a poetry slam team together, and we just were really compatible in our writing styles. And we wrote a lot of what are called group pieces, which are kind of like duets between two, we were performance poets, so a performative duet. We just were passionate about the same ideas. I think we had really similar cadences, similar humor. And we realized we could use these poems as kind of an educational vessel. And that was also a way to monetize our work. So colleges and universities are often looking for third-party educators when it comes to Title IX. And we'll talk more about that, I'm sure. But we started touring the country together, visiting colleges and performing. And I think that was the first time I really felt like a working writer. That was the first time I was making money as a writer. That was the first time that I felt like my creative brain was being harnessed in a way that felt sustainable. Mm-hmm. So I think throughout my life, I always knew that I wanted to end up there, but I just didn't know how, and that happened to be the way.
And I love what you said about like, even when you were writing as a short stories as a kid, like you always knew you were a writer. I find that so inspiring because I think I was someone that identified as an athlete and only one thing, but being a writer means, especially when you're writing fiction, you get to take on different characters and different people.
Yeah.
And so for a long time, because of sports, I didn't know that I had this kind of desire to explore my voice. I've always been a very loud, extroverted person. And I used to write in journals. I was always fascinated with like diaries, and I'd kind of like hoard them. And, but I never knew that that was an avenue that I could, one, use for my creativity and how it would like inform some of my other like working projects. But what I don't think you realize is you're actually one of the biggest inspirations behind creating Sparkle.
Oh, cool.
And you're like one of the reasons I write.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yeah. So I basically, when my sports career started coming like crashing down in 2015 of college at Xavier, I was exposed to what Title IX is for the first time. Yeah. For listeners that don't know, Title IX ensures that students are protected from sex discrimination in education. So that includes K through 12, and that also includes colleges. And so a lot of times people hear Title IX about that's an equal number of men and women's sports on campuses. And although that's like super important, it also creates a lot of different measures and accommodations if you experience harassment, violence, and so on and so forth. But what was going on at the time, it was February 2015, I was starting to get more exposed to some of the events on campus, which included like the women and gender department, and my friend encouraged me to come to your Speak Like a Girl. So for those of you watching, I'm wearing one of Olivia's old shirts from Speak Like a Girl. It says,
so cool.
Human decency is not foreplay.
I love that shirt so much.
I wear the shirt all the time. I have so many pictures in it. Like, it's my favorite because it spoke to me so much as far as what my situation was at the time. So I remember when you and Megan performed the poem about military sexual violence, I broke down. Mm-hmm. It was the first time that I acknowledged something that happened to me earlier that year. But then as the show progressed, it was like every single poem I could resonate with. And Human Decency Isn't Foreplay was resonating with me because there was someone at the time that I was friends with but didn't return feelings for. Mm-hmm. And that turned into a lot of threatening behavior. And I was so isolated. And then I went home that night. I bought your shirt. I went home that night and I wrote to you guys. And then all of a sudden, I started writing letters to that person that really just was acting threatening to me. And I never sent them. Mm-hmm. But from that day forward, I never stopped writing. Mm-hmm. And I guess I'm curious to know, because that's why like platforms that I wanted to create was like with Sparkle was where someone's work, where whether you knew it or not, impacted my individual life. Mm-hmm. And I believe stories do that. So when was there a catalyst moment that you were like, I'm using my writing for advocacy?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think in the, well, thank first of all, thank you for saying all of that. That's really, really moving and means a lot to me. So I started doing spoken word when I was, I think, 15. I was also an athlete. I played soccer for my whole life and also, like, didn't know how to choose. When you're a teenager, you feel like you have to choose between these two identities, which I wish someone had told me at that age. Like, you can just do both.
Yes.
You can be an athlete and an artist.
Yes.
I actually quit soccer to pursue poetry, which is so funny because it's like those two things don't have to be in conflict,
right?
But it felt like an identity change, you know. But I started doing spoken word when I was 15, and spoken word really is an art form of advocacy a lot of the time. So oftentimes these poets are talking about political issues, personal issues, the merging of the two. You're using your platform, literally a platform as a stage and a microphone to say something that matters. And so I feel like that was the prompt going in for me. Whereas before I was doing spoken word, I was maybe more writing from like a strictly emotional place, like just talking about,
you know, romance or writing fictional stories. I wrote a lot of like spy stories as a kid.
Then,
yeah, like I was really into Harriet the Spy. But then when I was, you know, when someone says to you as a teenager, what matters to you, you know, you have this opportunity to stand up on a stage and say something, what do you want to say? And I remember my first spoken word poem, I was 15 and it was about getting catcalled on the street. And I remember just like, it felt really good to have permission to be angry. And I don't even know that I was particularly, like, I don't even know that I had really been catcalled that much at that time. I think I just knew I was angry about something related to being a girl and being dehumanized because of it. I didn't exactly know what that was. I didn't exactly have the language around it. Of course, now I understand that, like, I was, you know, coming into my body. I was coming into my femininity. I think that I was seeing the way the world treated me differently in a multitude of ways. But I wrote this poem about getting catcalled. I focused on that. And my high school was doing like a poetry day. And it was really cool that my teacher, this woman named Miss Bernstein, worked really hard to organize it so that every class would come to the theater at the school and watch the poets perform for a whole day. So you got to perform in every class period for like 150 students. I went to a really big school.
Yeah.
So I performed this poem and I remember I got a pretty negative reaction from a group of boys. Mm-hmm. They started kind of like hollering in ways that were like kind of like protesting, like almost like making fun of me, but kind of offended. And it felt really good. I wasn't deterred. I felt like, oh, I like riled someone up, and I riled someone up who I meant to rile up. Like, that worked. That was effective, which says a lot about who I was and am. But I think it was interesting to me to realize that, like, these were boys that I would have never been able to communicate with otherwise. And suddenly I got through to them through this genre, which was like really powerful. And so I think that made me understand not only that that it was an effective method, but also that I had to think hard about what I did with this platform, what I said, because people were listening. Mm-hmm. You're not just on stage reading out of your diary about something that no one cares about. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about something that upsets you, when you're talking about something that's politicized, like gender politics, people are listening, and people are ready to either feel very validated or really upset. And it's like, you have to think hard about what you are going to say. So after that, I think I thought more critically about kind of what I was feeling, what it says about what my experience in the world was and what that says about the larger world. And it just started to shape my work. And I think I always stayed on that pathway of writing a lot about gender, a lot about identity. But of course, I was young, and so my life continued to happen,
right?
Which means that I continued to survive things as a girl. And, you know, there's always a bit of a lag in how long it takes to then process those things and write about them. But by the time Megan and I got together, you know, I had been through a lot and wanted to use that in a way that felt valuable.
And well, just like I was one of these people, but how did you practice that self-care when you were receiving the response to your work and also making sure that you were maintaining autonomy of these different identities? We kind of talked about how as young girls, at one point we felt like we had to choose when in reality we carry multitudes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious to know, because you always did have a response to your work, even from a young girl, how did you practice that care and exploration of yourself?
I mean, it was a huge learning. Like, no one gives you the tools for how to deal with being perceived. Mm-hmm. Like, and that's something that everyone deals with. I think especially young women deal with it. But especially if you're a young woman who's also on a stage being looked at, like, you have to navigate and work through a lot of opinions about who you are.
Mm-hmm.
I think because I came into poetry as from a place of real protest, like wanting to talk about what upset me, I did have this goal of upsetting people. Like, I was like, that feels good. And I think that's valuable. I think it's valuable for young women to harness their rage.
Yeah.
But I then also saw the other side of that, which is that that can be very scary. You know, I had a few moments of bigger exposure. Like when I was 18, my poetry team was featured on what was called Brave New Voices. It was kind of like deaf poetry jam for young people. It was on HBO. And it was by far the most exposure I'd ever had. And suddenly I was, you know, getting a lot of emails from like angry men, or men who were like interested in me. There was like a lot of feedback. It was, and I had to figure out what to take in and let sink inside me and what to brush off. A few years after that, I wrote a poem that kind of randomly got taken by it was called Radical Patriarchy. It was like a incel, like misogynist website. And their kind of mission was to basically find like feminists online and make their lives inhabitable on the internet. So they would kind of storm your inbox on every platform, your email, your Twitter account, your Instagram, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of death threats, rape threats, all because I'd written this one poem. And the poem was about masturbating. It was like my least political poem. It was a joke of a poem. But for some reason, it really upset them. Suddenly, I'm getting like, you know, thousands probably of these messages that are so hateful, so scary. And then I got doxxed. So my address got posted. And that was kind of that moment, that like record scratch where you're like, oh, this is real. And I realized then that it was so much less important to me in the grand scheme of things to piss people off, and so much more important to me to make people feel validated. So I realized so much of my attention actually when I was writing, so much of my focus was on what was on men. Like pissing men off, yes, but still on men.
Right.
And then I shifted that just a little bit to be like, okay, but what are girls feeling? Like, right. What are girls thinking? And shifting that was so valuable for my writing process, for my sense of safety, for my readership, my sense of community. It was like things just bloomed in this really beautiful way, because now my energy was focused on like love, you know? And that didn't mean I wasn't angry. That didn't mean my poems were no longer political. I didn't sacrifice any of that.
Right.
But I did have this pretty stark realization of like, whoa, it's no joke, you know, like being in the world and saying things that men are angry about. That's like a real scary, especially in 2014, the early 2000s or like 2000, early 2010s. We're a very dark time on the internet, I feel like.
Right.
So anyway, that was like a really crucial shift.
And two of your poetry collections that I wanted to kind of spotlight, Life of the Party and New American Best Friend. So Life of the Party really focuses on these nuances of these coming of age experiences, but also the impacts of violence. Whereas what I love about New American Best Friend as well is the how to turn the violence into joy. Mm-hmm. And when I do think about the ethos of the Sparkle Mission, I do think about that passion. And I kind of hate this notion where people believe or artists believe that work has to come out of this place of trauma and discomfort.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time arguing that, because Sparkle was born out of this rage and grief filled time in my life. But I was wondering if you could speak more to passion and rage and how they go hand in hand to inform maybe the rest of your artistic approach and career throughout your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I also struggle with that notion. And I think part of what we struggle with is that we do create from that place, and you don't want to feel like you can only create from that place.
Right.
So I think that writing if this is the way that your brain is organized, writing is a crucial tool for processing. Mm-hmm. And I think is kind of irreplaceable. Like you need language to process, I think, a lot of the time. And so writing from a place of hurt or pain or fear or anger is really important. But I think the idea that you need those feelings in order to write is a huge myth. You know, mm-hmm. I actually think you can continue. I think these experiences that these difficult experiences we go through are inevitably going to shape our work, but you'll continue to work through them. You'll continue to write about them, you know, from different angles. Right. You don't have to continue to experience pain in order to keep writing. There are things that I experienced when I was 13 that I'm still writing about, mm-hmm. and I'm writing about them in new and interesting ways. I'm writing about them in smarter ways as I get older. My perspective on them changes. Like it's, I think that, and even when I'm in a happy place in my life, I actually feel at times even more capable of mm-hmm. broaching those subjects because they aren't as scary, you know, because I do feel confident. So I feel like there's this, I think, yeah, the idea that you can't write if you're feeling good implies that you can only write about an experience one time. Maybe it is valuable for you to process difficult things in your writing, but you can go back to those things from a good place, you know, and see what changes. Like, I think that's so important, you know, but yeah, I hate the idea that someone would need to stay in a place of hardship in order to create.
And then how would you suggest people that aren't, you know, writing for their career or anything like that, how would you advise them to approach writing as a tool for processing?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think letters are a really great format. Mm-hmm. They feel private, which I think gives people a lot of bravery. I think that, you know, looking to other writers is always really helpful. I think ultimately, like, artists are mimics. And so, like, seeing what forms other writers are taking on, like, did someone write an ode that you love, that, and do you feel like there's something you can write, an ode that's similar or an ode to the same thing but a different perspective? I think that a lot of what deters people about writing is feeling like they don't know where to start. They don't know what shape this thing is going to take. And so starting from a prompt is really helpful because it gives you a kind of container. So I think a letter is a great place to start, even like a letter to a former self. I know that sounds cliche, but I think that's because it's immediate for so many people. So many people hear that and they know exactly what they want to say.
Do you have a prompt that's like one of your favorites that you always go to?
Yeah, I feel like a prompt that inspired a lot of things I've written was odes to my shame. So I'd choose something that I felt particularly ashamed of, and I would write an ode to it, which is a praise poem. So doing the opposite of what you would usually do, which is punish that thing and tell that thing to go away and to go get quiet, but instead uplifting it and looking at it and saying, how has this helped me? How has this been valuable to me? What about this thing, even if it hasn't helped me, how can I love this thing? Like, what about this thing is vulnerable or tender? And sometimes it doesn't even end up as an ode, but just starting from that place gives you something to really hyper focus on, mm-hmm. which I think produces some of the best work.
Going back to kind of what we talked about earlier with putting ourselves in identity boxes, I've also noticed over your creative writing journey that you've been able to write different films and use your poems to inform different types of writing and projects. How did you basically realize the step to go about that, and how would you advise other writers to have creative play with other mediums?
I think it's easy to get stuck in one medium, especially if you begin to feel like it's a language, it's the language you speak, mm-hmm. and when you get kind of good at it, whatever that means, but when you get to a place where you feel like you understand it, you don't want to go into a genre that you then are maybe going to not be great at, you know, of course. So I think the first step is probably just accepting that you're not going to be great at something immediately. But you are walking into that into it as a writer already. Right. And so you're already walking into it with a certain set of tools that a lot of people don't have. So I've found that even when I've been intimidated by a genre like screenwriting, I can step into it and go, oh, this is similar to poetry in this way. This is similar to fiction in this way. Like I can apply the things I already know. But I also think it's really important to look at every story that you want to tell and genuinely ask yourself what this story wants to be, because it doesn't always want to be a poem.
Right.
And I think for a long time, I tried to make everything into a poem, which can be great and also can really limit the story that you can tell. So my poetry is largely autobiographical. So if I'm looking at every story and going, how can this be a poem? Then I'm looking at every story and I'm going, what is my experience with this? How can I center myself in this? Whereas in screenplays or in fiction, I'm going, how does this story exist in the world? What are the characters that can exist around this story? What are the multitude of perspectives that are looking at this story? And that's really exciting. It's really important. And it's been so freeing also to write from a perspective other than my own. So I feel like every story does actually want to be something specific. And it's just a matter of letting yourself see that.
Yeah. And I think like sometimes what I experience is I have to sometimes write in another medium to understand what actually sometimes even the story is,
yeah,
or even that chapter or memory. So I write a lot of personal essay and memoir, but sometimes I will have to go write a short film, or I'll have to write song lyrics,
yeah,
from the perspective of even other characters maybe. And then it's like what emerges is maybe a really bad song because I can't sing or play music, so it's maybe just a really bad poem, but it's what I'm able to get the rawest emotion,
yeah,
extracted again, because I think especially with personal essay there's sometimes this wall that we put up so we don't dive into these emotions, and we label that as writer's block.
Sure. Yeah.
Where it's like, I experience writer's block. Sure, we can call it that, but it's more this wall that I don't want to face these emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some real power being able to put the same resonance in a different character that doesn't look like me,
mm-hmm,
and isn't a woman. And then realize this is the message that's actually coming across.
Totally.
And so I was actually wondering, what was your experience and initial spark that created this novel, Whoever You Are, Honey?
Yeah, I had never written a novel before and was very intimidated to do so. But I've always really loved stories about fembots because I have always felt this like deep kinship to the robot at the center, which is ultimately like a girl that has been created by men. And I think that that's something I've struggled with for a lot of my life, is feeling like so much of my identity has been shaped by men that I've loved, men that I've wanted to love me. And I've had moments like in my early 20s where I was like, who am I? Like, I don't actually know who I am without the input of these men that I've existed in the context of.
A tale as old as time.
Totally. Yeah, literally. I mean, the first movie about a fembot was in the silent film era, you know, about a man inventing a robot woman and then kind of grappling with her sentience. So I've always loved stories about fembots, but I wanted to write one that centered women, that didn't center the male inventor and his feelings, but instead was about women's relationships to each other, how women embolden each other's humanity, liberate each other into a more authentic humanity, but also the ugly parts of relationships between women, the parts that feel really daunting and intimidating for a lot of girls. And so, yeah, that's kind of where I started. And that is a theme I think I'd written about in my poetry a lot. And I think I was yearning to explore it from a different place because, like you said, I wanted to get deeper. And I think I was feeling limits with my own perspective.
What's the inspiration behind making the setting in Santa Cruz, California?
So I came up with the idea when I lived there. So I was really surrounded by the world of tech. Santa Cruz is quickly becoming a really popular place for people who work in tech to live when they leave San Francisco. My mom grew up in Santa Cruz, mm-hmm. and I grew up hearing about Santa Cruz as this place that was always at odds with itself. Like my mom always talked about how, you know, when she was growing up, Santa Cruz was this kind of like remote country town. She like rode a donkey to school, which is very like, that's Santa Cruz. That's also very my mother. Like it's not everyone in Santa Cruz rides a donkey to school, but like, and then, you know, at some point in her life, the university moved in, UC Santa Cruz, and suddenly the town was overtaken by elite academics and it started to change, and the locals were really resentful of that change. The home prices started going up, like gentrification started happening, social dynamics started changing, the reputation of the city was changing. And then when I lived there, the exact same thing was happening, but it was happening with tech. So now the academics were the locals and the resentment was towards these people moving in who worked in tech and who were buying up homes and rebuilding them. And I got really fascinated by the social impact of that. I got really interested in the way that young men who work in tech interact with the world, what it means to be a young man who kind of believes in his capacity to play God so wholeheartedly that he actually like ends up playing God, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm both really impressed by that and also terrified of it. And so, Santa Cruz just kind of remained this perfect location for that story to take place.
And what I loved is that, so like, I think a lot with like personal essay and memoir is like the author narrator character split, but how as a writer were you able to put yourself in the two different characters of these two women, mm-hmm. and really kind of bring this world that it's almost like I'm really obsessed with Elena Ferrante's My Brilliant Friend,
mm-hmm. which I have not read, criminally so, but it's on my list. I'm going to read it this year.
Well, what I love about that series is kind of what we talked about, these two girls from a young age all the way through adulthood, and they're surrounded by this world of patriarchy in this very small town in southern Italy. And so, like you said, you want to show the good that two women can do for each other in this concentrated world, but then also some of the darkness. Mm-hmm. Why do you think narratives like that are important now more than ever?
You know, I think that there is a lot of... I was thinking about this trajectory earlier where, like, you know, in the kind of early 2000s, it was sort of cool to be friends with all boys. Like that was a cool thing to do, was like to be the cool girl that I'm not friends with other girls. Like they're too dramatic. I'm friends with guys. And I was very much one of those girls, partially because I played sports. Like some of it is just situational.
Yeah.
But some of it is because you're like, this is how I access power. This is how I access desirability. Like this is where I'm going to go. Mm-hmm. So that I think was kind of a trend. And then there was this, you know, feminist critique of that trend, which was like, this is ultimately a product of misogyny. This kind of like putting yourself in closer proximity to boys and saying that you're not like other girls is a product of internalized misogyny. And, you know, we see this in like Gone Girl, this monologue, the cool girl monologue, mm-hmm. This idea of like a woman who's just like a walking paradox. She's a virgin and a whore. She, you know, can like eat a million hot dogs but never gains weight. Like she's loves to drink, but she's not a sloppy drunk. She loves to have sex, but she's like totally respectable. You know, like there's this kind of thing, and that woman doesn't exist because people like that don't exist, but it exists in the male imagination. And so women try their hardest to emulate that. And then came the term pick me girl, which is now kind of circulating. And I think all those critiques are super valid and important. But what I think is equally as important is understanding where this pick me girl comes from. Like it is internalized misogyny, but what's the deeper vulnerable truth there?
Yeah.
And I think the deeper vulnerable truth is that it can be really intimidating to become friends with women, because friendships with women are incredibly intimate. they demand a vulnerability that is can be really scary for people to embark on. Friendship breakups with other girls are incredibly difficult and oftentimes heartbreaking, you know? And in some ways you could say that that's drama, but I think there is a complexity to friendships between women that is so beautiful and important. And also when you're a young teenager can feel alienating and scary. And so I think that I wanted to explore that fear a little more, you know, in this book. Also, this character is queer, and I think she's afraid of what her own desire might look like. And I think queer girls also feel that, this feeling of like, I'm almost like I'm not allowed to have that intimacy because what if it's misconstrued for desire? Mm-hmm. I'm not allowed to like be in the locker room with other girls because I'm dangerous, you know? So I kind of wanted to get into like the tender spot of the pick me girl, and both of these characters, Mitty and Lena, are both kind of pick me girls in their own ways. And I just wanted to see them as human beings.
So what was your actual process for developing these two individual characters around this notion of kind of exploring this fear that was a curiosity that drove you, but also the pick me girl?
I mean, I think it's a product of a lot of drafts. You know, your first draft, you always are going to lean back on tropes that are, you know, things you've seen before. I think that naturally you're going to write more one-dimensional villains. You're going to, I think your characters are just less complex. And so I think it was a matter of just going back and back and back and continually asking myself, you know, what is she actually saying here? What is she actually feeling here? Is there even a deeper, darker truth that I'm just afraid to broach? Mm. Am I trying to make this character too likable? Like, am I protecting her in some way? An analogy I think of sometimes is that, you know, writing characters is kind of like you're a lifeguard at a pool and you're watching all these people swim. And when one of them, you know, starts to drown, or one of them starts to get rough with another one, your instinct is to jump in and break it up and protect everyone. But as a writer, I think you have to just stay there and watch them fight their way out, which I think is makes for the best stories, because that's when we get to see the real kind of gritty, sometimes ugly, but ultimately really rewarding humanity on page.
That's a really beautiful analogy. I think it speaks to a lot of encouraging people to write into either their obsessions mm-hmm. or their fears.
Yeah.
And it seems like you do that a lot. And so I'm kind of curious of how you continuously urge yourself to take that leap of faith, whether that's getting on stage and performing a new poem mm-hmm. or leaning into something like this that blossoms into a novel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a matter of just always asking yourself, like, what am I not saying, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that goes back to the idea, this idea that you always need to be in pain in order to write. Mm-hmm. You really don't. I think you just always have to be asking yourself what you're not saying. What
right.
is there more to say, you know? And maybe you're saying it from a place of joy. Maybe you're saying it from a place of curiosity. Maybe you're saying it from a place of rage. But there's always something more to say. And so I think that I am routinely surprised at how I can think I've written everything about a subject. And then I'm alive for one more year, or I experience one more relationship, or, you know, I read one more book, or I have one more conversation, and suddenly I have so much more to say about that thing.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like just asking yourself that question always, you know.
What is your biggest hope that with the book, that the impact that it will make?
I hope that it opens up conversations about particularly, that complexity of friendships between women. I think that, you know, there's a lot in the book about AI. There's a lot in the book about tech. I think that's really fun. It's interesting. It's exciting. But I think what I feel is a conversation that maybe isn't happening enough is this idea that, you know, beneath that internalized misogyny, there's a real real source of shame that I think girls and women feel, and it prevents them from seeking closeness with each other. And so I hope that, you know, it encourages readers to think about their own relationships. I hope that, I always hope that people read my work and feel inspired to write. but yeah, I hope that it opens up some of those conversations.
And so I think what I find interesting is, especially when we're talking about this idea of closeness and female friendships, I do think about colleges and these kind of this weird microcosm, right? Whether we're talking about the robot world of our college campuses, is like, at least on a team, what I've actually been playing around with this idea a lot is, so I went into Xavier as a cross country and track runner, never really thinking about who I wanted to be friends with. When you come in on a sports team, you think that that's supposed to be your built-in family or your built-in like best friends. And it is, I was grateful for it in a lot of ways, right? But I never stopped and thought about the differences and the ways that we didn't mesh or didn't align because we were forced to see each other every day. And then there's the notion of trauma bonding when life starts getting real, as you know, college is this environment that you're supposed to be able to grow into an adulthood. And so that specifically brings me to your education work on Title IX on college campuses. How have you seen in your work the ways in which women specifically maybe trauma bond and what that actually means for the longevity of friendship?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's like such a delicate balance, you know, between of like finding intimacy with another woman by opening up to each other and understanding that you have this shared experience. Oftentimes that shared experience is one of surviving violence, specifically from men. But then how do you balance that with making sure that your connection is one where you are actually seeing each other as fully dimensional human beings and not just connecting on the parts of yourself that are the most in pain? It's something I'm still trying to figure out, to be honest. I probably always will be. I don't think the solution is closing yourself off. But, you know, when I was teaching on campuses, I think that was something that I did have a moment where I realized that my work was, I could see very clearly the value of my work. There were so many girls coming up to me and telling me their stories, telling me about how my work had helped them realize what they'd experienced, had validated their experiences. And that is such an incredible gift as a writer. And I had moments of wondering, like, are my readers trauma bonding with my work? What does it mean for, and am I trauma bonding with my readers? What does it mean for your work, for the purpose of your work to be centered around pain, you know? And I think I reached a point where I started to feel like, not necessarily that I had to be in pain in order to write, but that I had to be writing about pain in order to have value. And that is when I think I kind of drew the line and was like, I need to start getting into bigger stories, because at some point it's counteractive to my healing, you know. Going around college campuses and talking about sexual violence every single day for months and months on end was extremely taxing. It was so rewarding and so taxing because you're getting on stage, you're reliving your own trauma, and then you're hearing about other people's trauma, and then you're providing them with insight and validation, and then your relationship with them is cut short and you leave, and then you have to go and you do that again. And so it's this really weird process that I'm so grateful for, and I did have to check myself at one point because I think there was a lot of trauma bonding happening.
How do you think that
the education of Title IX or specifically violence on campus with these workshops will change now that we've seen Title IX go through these different changes and the new revisions are intact August 1st this year.
What are the new revisions?
So we went through a series of rollbacks under the Trump administration.
Sure.
And then the Biden administration has put in new revisions where it will, the Trump administration basically allowed for cross-examination during the Title IX hearing process. They also allowed for basically lawyer representatives of the perpetrator side, alleged perpetrator side, and the victim. A lot of rollbacks that would harm the LGBTQ community. I mean, sure. The list goes on and on.
Yeah.
So the Biden administration has made some improvements, still lacking as far as the protection of the LGBTQ community. But schools will be forced to comply by August 1st. And I feel like as far as you being an educator, it's like this constant need to go with what the administration at the time is saying.
Yeah.
And with God knows what's happening with the Department of Education.
Yeah.
I'm curious to know how this work continues.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's true that as an educator, you do have to abide by what an administration is telling you to do. And also you can get really creative, you know. So like, for instance, I've taught some sex ed and I've taught sex ed in districts that are abstinence-only education, which I absolutely don't agree with, right. But I have to abide by. And so then what you do is you go, okay, well, where's the truth in this? The truth is that the only way to 100% avoid getting pregnant or to not get pregnant, the only way to 100% not get pregnant is to not have penis and vagina sex. That is the only way, 100%.
Yep.
So then there's some other things, you know, you add on, like you can make these statements that abide by that administration's rules, and then you can move on and have a complicated conversation, you know. Maybe I'm not allowed to tell the students about, you know, maybe I'm not allowed to hand out condoms, but I can certainly talk about condoms, you know. I can certainly, like, suggest where one might find condoms. So I think that we dealt with that a lot when we were teaching Title IX, we taught at religious universities. We had, I think, taught at schools where we weren't allowed to talk about sex, but we were there to also teach about sexual violence. So then you find yourself making a lot of analogies. So teaching about consent, talking about, you know, borrowing something from someone, you always ask to borrow something. The difference between borrowing and stealing is asking for consent. So there, I'm not talking about sex, but I'm talking about sex, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that a good educator is creative under restriction. And what I hope is that, you know, Title IX education in particular remains creative, because I think it can also easily become very kind of quota meeting. It can be very like, this box has been checked, this box has been checked.
Right.
Without really looking at, like, what is the culture on campus? Where is this coming from? You know, I taught a workshop once at an Army base, and it was really wild because, you know, I'm on the Army base teaching this workshop, and I'm like, okay, they brought me here to talk about sexual violence because there's an issue of sexual violence here. However, we're also teaching these young boys how to feel no empathy. We're also teaching these young boys how to kill other people. I was watching, you know, Army sergeants like call these boys horrific names and then send them into my workshop where I'm supposed to teach them how to have empathy. Like it's right. Completely counter. It doesn't work, you know? And I'm not saying, you know, I'm not going to get into, like, you know, the Army, but I do think that hopefully, what Megan and I were trying to do was introduce an education that did feel a little more comprehensive and specific, and not just, okay, well, I've told you what,
you know, sex discrimination is. I've defined it for you. Okay, like that box has been checked. Thank you very much, you know.
And I'm kind of curious because, like you said, we don't want to get into the army and like the state of college campuses. We also campuses, can't. But no. I'm just saying like the state of college campuses is kind of unknown right now.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious of what your opinion is of how we help listeners either express or write from a place of joy. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times you hear that prompt be, what is it like to write from a wound? Mm-hmm. And I think despite these restrictions that exist in these, you know, stringent environments, what do you believe is a place to express yourself from joy?
You know, well, I think that survival is a really great place to start. You know, I think that like looking at all you have survived can be a really joyful thing. If you're here, you have survived it, you know. I think that's why I encourage odes, because they do push a person to start from a place of celebration, even if that's hard. It's kind of like in therapy how I've had therapists be like, okay, look at this version. There's a version of yourself you really hate. How can you comfort her? Like, how can you think of this version of yourself as a child? Like, what would you say to this childlike version of yourself? You wouldn't yell at her. You know, you wouldn't say terrible things. You would love on her. So I feel like starting with those kinds of celebrations is important. It can be really hard to look out at the world and feel celebratory, I think, especially when we're looking at the political climate. Mm-hmm. When we're looking at things like administrations, it's hard to feel hopeful. It's hard to feel joyful. So I think starting from a personal space is probably more fruitful.
Yeah. And I think that's what's, you know, so special about if we're able to celebrate ourselves and really express ourselves in a space, whether that's painting, writing, it does make the world that we want to live in seem more achievable.
Yeah.
But I wanted to know if you wanted to share like your favorite excerpt from your new novel.
Sure.
Or anything.
Yeah.
I can do
that.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's.
I love hearing you read, and like there was like so many points throughout, like when you were talking, I was like, that sounds like a poem.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, I can do this one. Okay. All right. So there's a character in this book who, her name's Lena, and she is basically struggling to access her own memory. So she is in this relationship with this tech entrepreneur, and she's beginning to feel like that's her entire identity, and that nothing came before him. Before continuing to unpack, Sebastian asks her to undress and shower with him. They take turns swirling soap against each other's shoulder blades. They hardly speak, switching in and out of the hot water as though choreographed. Even now, they rarely bathe apart, a tradition they've kept since they met. It had occurred to Lena that this practice might curdle their sex life, turn the other person's body into something too familiar. But they haven't struggled with maintaining desire, not once, even though there have been periods, days, weeks, during which he was the only person Lena saw. The notion that he would ever not be a mystery was almost unfathomable. Every time Sebastian walked into the room, she felt exactly how she did the first time she ever laid eyes on him, at a party on a rooftop in Soma. It was January 2 years ago, chilly even for San Francisco that time of year, but Lena hadn't been cold in her black dress with a square neckline, the open-toed pale green mules with straps that wrapped around her ankles. She stood at the railing, watching some poor soul work in their illuminated office in the high-rise across the street, wondering what they were doing that was so important that they needed to be there at 11 o'clock on a Saturday. That's when she heard a man's voice behind her. What could be so important that they're doing it at 11 o'clock on a Saturday? but when she turned around to face him, she wasn't sure if he had said it first or if she'd just accidentally said it out loud to herself and then he'd repeated it. He joined her in looking out at the city and began giving her an aerial tour. He told her about the 48 hills, that on one particularly steep hill, sometime in the 1860s, a team of horses slipped as they pulled a car up Kearney Street, and how their gruesome tumble back down the hill inspired a distraught onlooker to design the cable car. He talked about how good design saves lives. Then he switched topics, rattling off a litany of myths and legends about the city, the labyrinth of ghost tunnels underneath Chinatown, the rogue hippie who kidnapped a tiger from the zoo. He didn't ask her many questions, but he didn't talk about himself much either, which made Lena feel at ease, like he was neither consumed with trying to figure her out nor trying to make her understand him. He talked about the ever-widening class gap that had progressively managed to ruin a city that was once home to outcasts and dreamers. One of the few times he used the word I was when he implicated himself in that evolution, admitting that he, too, was part of the tech industry that corrupted San Francisco, though he never quite explained whether or not he forgave himself for it. They walked the long way past back to his house in Dog Patch, past the sparkling new basketball stadium and the recently shuttered doors of what had once been the oldest black-owned bar in San Francisco, arriving finally at his shipyard warehouse turned loft. He joked about how he'd once gone to a rave here, before the steel frame windows were cleaned of their calcium fog and the once communal bathrooms on each floor had been converted to walk-in closets, when it was still an actual warehouse. Then he pointed to the corner where he'd nearly vomited on Jack Dorsey, the bike messenger. He made her a Negroni and sprinkled orange wedges with sugar. He opened all the windows, and they sat on the floor where he grew wistful as he described how the city used to feel invigorating and chaotic and full of potential. He told her about wanting to leave for somewhere smaller, somewhere stuck in its ways, somewhere without billboard ads for cryptocurrency looming over the freeway, somewhere uncool with bad food. Lena gently suggested that there were other parts of the city that hadn't yet been overrun, but he wasn't convinced. "We're everywhere," he said. "I want to go where there's less of me." He noticed things about her that seemed trivial. Then he explained why they were actually useful. The fact that her ability to taste the dash of cinnamon in her drink meant she had an advanced palate. That based on their wrestling match on his glossy concrete floor, her strength-to-weight ratio meant she'd be a natural rock climber. Her vision was insane, which, among other things, would make her a fantastic bird watcher. She liked how he made her feel, like she was capable, and more than that, like she was remarkable. He was more passionate about her potential than her past. It was rare to find that in a man, she thought, someone who doesn't feel threatened by all the things you could become.
Wonderful.
Thank you.
I just love how much like the setting in itself is a character.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And yeah, it's everything about your writing is so rhythmic. It's just, yeah, it mesmerizes me.
Thank you.
Well, is there anything else you'd love to share about any upcoming projects or anything else like that?
Well, I'm adapting the book into a movie.
I also didn't know if you could give it away yet.
Yeah, I can.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I'm working with Lucky Chap, with Margot Robbie's company.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Thank you. And I'm doing the adaptation, so I'm excited. I haven't started it yet, but we'll see what happens.
Oh, are you going to be a producer on that as well?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope so. I'm such a, like, control freak. But I have, you know, I have a pretty clear vision in my mind for what this could look like. So yeah,
that's amazing. I'm so happy to hear, because I was wondering, and I like that she's doing it.
Yeah. I think it's up her alley.
Love that for you. Well, congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And one of the things that we do on the show is kind of talk about our small wins. Sure. So like, I think sometimes, like we were talking about earlier, is we tie big career wins as our self-worth. Mm-hmm. And I want to encourage listeners to really embrace, you know, that amazing couple on the street that just like bought someone else a coffee mm-hmm. randomly and things like that. So is there anything in your last week that you can identify as your small wins?
Yeah, I like, this is so weird to say, but I like made a friend.
No, I love that.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I made a friend. And, you know, yeah, I made a friend, like, enough to be like, oh, we should get a drink sometime, you know?
Cool.
Which is like a very vulnerable thing to do in your adulthood, I think. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I felt good about that.
I think that's really important. And I think now more than ever, you know, coming out of the pandemic, we all need to like try to make a new friend.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It's and I think, yeah, getting into adulthood and like thinking about what kinds of friends you want in your mm-hmm. life, because there's like a new opportunity to do that in yeah. your kind of grown up years. You know, you're not in situations where you're on a team and so the friends are implied, or you're in a class together, so the friends are implied. You have to like find them, but that, and that's scary, but that's also exciting because you get to choose them.
Yeah, you have to put yourself out there. And my mom always says friendships and people are seasons, reasons, and lifetime.
Oh, I love that.
And that always sticks with me. And yeah, tis so the true. Season.
Yeah, it is the season.
Tis the season. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening to Olivia Gatwood about her new book, Whoever You Are, Honey. I'll share it in the show notes, but don't forget, sparkle on.
Sparkle on.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thank you.